My name is Nina Sigalowitz. I was born Anne Marie Thrasher. I'm in Iqaluit and Dene Cho from Fort Smith, Northwest Territories. And I am a cultural consultant, an Aboriginal cultural consultant for different organizations. And what I offer is cultural sensitization about Aboriginal reality. I was transported from Fort Smith to Montreal, Quebec, through the 60s scoop. I was stolen from my mother and father, and I ended up in a very loving home in Montreal. And back then in the 70s, 60s and 70s, the English sector of social services was run by Jewish Family Services. So when my parents went to go adopt, it was through the Jewish Family Services, which is why very many of us, there must be, I think, about 15 of us or 20 of us in Montreal who were adopted all by Jewish Family Services. Jewish families, because they all went through Jewish Family Services. Both my parents at the time were, I think, my father was a professor of psychology at Concordia, which he still is. My mother, I think, was working on her thesis, and she also became a professor of linguistics at Concordia. But my upbringing, like, they had, after they adopted me, they had a natural daughter, who was my younger sister, who was 2 years younger than me. And I grew up in Outremont, and then we moved to NDG. I started, one of the different ways I grew up was, I started taking cello lessons when I was 3 through the Suzuki method. And that was really my social circle. But until I was 18, I had never met another Native person. So they had me do a lot of enriching things, like both being professors, you know. My education was of the utmost importance. But I think back then in the 70s and the 80s, there was no real push for families who adopted Native kids to really encircle them or to expose them to their own culture and community. So back then there was a lot of racism and fear. And I had Hebrew lessons when I was a kid. I had Tagalog lessons when I was a kid. I went to synagogue once in a while. I went to church once in a while. But I wasn't really exposed except for the, there was once in a while exposure through like CBC,
Sesame Street, yeah.
Same read.
Oh, thank God for Buffy.
Right? And there was like through the Canadian Heritage Moments where they had like those minutes of like, what are, you know, Native people or Igloos or something. So mm-hmm. It was a hard upbringing because I saw a lot of culture. I lived in China for a year with my parents in Beijing, and we traveled all over Mongolia and Russia China and Hong Kong and Japan and the Philippines and Denmark. And so I saw all these cultures, but when I would look in the mirror, I really had no idea who I was, or what it meant to be, you know, or what it meant to be an Eskimo. Back then it was an Eskimo. So, and I also suffered a lot of sexual abuse in the house. So people say, oh, well, you must have been so lucky, you know, like to grow up in, like, in this great home where you play cello and all these things, you got to travel. And I said, you know what? I said, you know, it's true. It's true, but what people don't know is that I suffered at the hands of my grandfather and my uncle. And so it's really, yeah, it's, so my upbringing was about surviving, but it was also about, well, my parents, you know, I recently, over the years, I realized that what my parents didn't do, which also not saved me, but offered me a safer place, which was, no one drank in the house. There was no swearing. There was no fighting. There was no drugs. There was, I guess I lived in a middle class or upper middle class. So in terms of materialistic and in terms of safety, I led a very structured, safe environment. Like, to be honest, like, the more I think about it, like, I think I hear about my friends who lived on the res, and there was, like, drinking and fighting and violence and swearing, and I was like, my days were filled with listening to my father play on his baby grand piano.
How did you navigate your intersectionality with the people that you were going to school with? Because I'm assuming there weren't any other Native kids at school. And so how did you do that internally? And then externally, what did your circle of friends look like? And were you accepted? And did you feel community there?
It was interesting because, you know, in elementary school, I went to Family Gardens. And back then, there was a lot of racism. And what the kids called me was contaminated. And I didn't know what it meant. Like, I just knew what it meant, but I didn't know why they were saying that I was. And they wouldn't say anything about anybody else like that. And I didn't realize that, like, in the 70s, that it was really okay to say that to a Native person. You know what I mean? Like, it filtered mm-hmm. down, you know, from parents and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, like, in high school was a little bit better because I had made friends and I had some friends that, it was interesting because growing up, I forgot what I looked like. Like, I would try to be like, I would try to morph and I would switch to it. Now there's a word that I have to put to what I did when I was a child. When I was with my Filipino family, I would be a chameleon. So I would start talking like them and their accent. And then I would be with my father's side of the family, who were very intellectuals. Majority of them have their PhD in something, psychology, or a couple of them are lawyers and doctors, and so I would code switch right away, and I would hope when I was a child that people would forget that I looked like the way I looked. And so in school, I would do the same thing. I went to Sacred Heart School of Montreal, and I graduated in 1990. So internally, I was still looking for who I was, really. I was searching for clues. I remember building an igloo outside on Curves in Outremo because I had seen this thing, maybe Nanook of the North or something, being an Eskimo, and we would make igloos. So I went outside on Curves in Outremo, which is where I grew up, and there was a lot of Hasidic families across the street, and they were, I think they watched me in the middle of the winter trying to build an igloo, and I'm not really sure what their impression was of me, but I was so proud of myself. So internally, I would make steps to find out, but my circle of friends really came from the Suzuki family. Like, I played cello since I was 3, and music somehow really let me open up and become more of who I was than I was in school, because I played the cello, and I was one of the older ones, and I was more of a leader, and it really helped me learn how to socialize with boys or how to make friendships with people. And it was really a way for me to express myself. And I did that until I was 17.
And at that time, did you know anything about Inuit music or any sort of artistic practice, creative practice that Inuit have in their culture?
I had no exposure. I had no idea what Native music sounded like. I had no idea what how music was. I had no idea what handjumming was. I had no clue, like zero.
Wow. And did you ever ask your parents, like, I would like to do this? Could you?
No, I didn't know. I knew that there was a part of me that was missing, but I couldn't ask for something that I didn't know didn't exist because it wasn't even around me. It wasn't like, you know, today where I'm sure had I, you know, asked on Google, like, what is being an Inuk mean, then I would have had, like, YouTube videos. Yeah. I would have, even thinking about it now, even in the encyclopedia, which is what I had back then, children's encyclopedia, I didn't remember looking at pictures of, like, Indians or whatever, not even close.
So when did that become your, like, one of your main drives? Like, you said, okay, I'm going to do this. I want to reconnect. I want to find out who I am.
Well, when I was 16, it was interesting. I went through, you know, being a teenager, and I was like, I want to meet my mother, my biological mother. And that was the year she died. I didn't know this at the time. But I was like, I had to push so much. I needed to go see my parents, my mother. And my parents They said no. They said it would be safer for you to meet her as an adult to adult and not child to. And I don't know where that came from. I really don't. To this day, I think that that was just their thought process. And I think, you know, it was part of me is still angry at them.
Maybe they just thought you wouldn't be able to process it, or it would be too much for you, or...
But regardless, they took that choice away from me.
Absolutely.
Like, even as I'm thinking about it now, like I could have met her.
Yes.
But they took that away from me.
Do you think there was something in that moment of you that sounds so like the creator was telling you to go?
Oh, yeah. Because up until then, I had never really thought of meeting her specifically. But that summer, I was like, I need to find, and I never approached my parents to ask them to do this kind of thing. So I think that it also took them off guard. Like, things happen for a reason. Mm-hmm. And I can't, there's certain things over life that I realize that I can't control. And I've come to sort of a piece of it, but I think, as becoming a parent too, I became a lot more forgiving.
Oh yeah, I'm right there with you.
Like, you're just like, wow. Okay. All right.
You said that things happen for a reason. I do believe that too, and I feel like when we're really open and accepting, it's just kind of okay. I have to let this wash over me. I have to just move on. And do you feel like you've come to a point where you know what that reason might be, or it's just enough to know that things happen? And
I don't think I'm ever going to know the reason, because there's certain things that I do understand why things, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, that's why I didn't go because of this, you know, oh, I'm glad I followed my gut because of this. But this was something that was just such a strong instinct in me. And then after that, I didn't think about it for a year. And then when I was 18, that's when I first met my first Native person, at the Native Friendship Center in Montreal. It just like exploded. You know, growing up, I had no idea who I was, and I very much was, you know, a defender of the Jewish faith, of the like Filipino culture, and I was all about learning about the Holocaust, and I was very, very like passionate about the underdog and all this stuff. And then when I became part of my community, what I realized now is it's a natural part of the process, but I completely immersed myself in my community, and I pretty much rejected everything else. You know, as much as for 18 years I was not immersed at all. I went the other way, but I just completely was no longer about anything but my community. And it was 1990 when I was starting to, so it was like, it was a very emotional and intense time to learn about who you are. So,
and are you referring in particular, the Oka standoff?
Yeah, the Oka standoff, and also not knowing my community. I didn't know the scope of what was going on. But all I saw were people pulling together and people standing up for something that I wasn't really sure about, but I just saw strength, and I saw a lot of things in my community that would later on, I understand now, really shaped who I am, which is the strong women that took me under their wing, you know, and I was so happy to finally meet people who look like me. Because what you have to understand is my father is 5'10". And he has blue eyes. He has curly brown hair. He's pale. He's white. My mom was Filipino. And she was 5 foot.
Just for reference, so your mom is 5 foot. And how tall are you?
I'm 5'11". But I always forgot. I forgot when I was with my family that I look like the way I look.
Right. Well, then tell me about, when did you meet your family, and how did you feel seeing people that look like you? What was that like?
Well, it was interesting because when I first went to the Friendship Center, I went there by the Hazal, I needed food. I was starving, you know. Mm-hmm. I was really nervous because growing up, I never felt really seen or accepted for who I was. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what if they look at me and know that I know nothing about anything?
Right.
Who I am, except me looking the way I look. Like, and I was really super nervous about that.
Did it feel like you were kind of like, I have to fool them into thinking that I'm actually...
I didn't even get that far in my process. Like, okay. I was just afraid of them being, of them accepting me to begin with.
Right.
Like, are they going to let me in? I don't speak my languages. I don't know anything about nothing. So, like, are they going to still feed me? And it was interesting because when I opened the door for the first time, there is a woman who was sitting there, and she and I are now friends, and her name is Litya, and she was the first Inuk woman I met, and she turned around when I opened the door, and she was right there with her beautiful smile and her beautiful brown skin and her long hair, and so gingerly I started becoming part of the Native Friendship Center. And at the time, the executive director was Ida LaBilwa, mentor. She tells me today that she saw me come into the center and she knew exactly what I was going through. She knew I was one of the stolen ones. She just knew that I was looking for myself. Right away, she put me to work. She sent me off to Winnipeg to represent Aboriginal youth at a solvent abuse workshop. And I had no idea what I was doing. So during this conference, I saw a lot of Native women, Native girls that were my age, young women who were, like, having their braids and chokers and beadwork. And so I started doing the same thing. Like, I started wearing beads and chokers and thinking, well, that, now I look Native.
Mm-hmm.
Inside, I was slowly building the sense of who I was.
Yep.
And so I started doing these things. And I remember during this workshop, there was... they had an eagle feather. I had no idea what an eagle feather was. And everyone was passing it around and holding it. And what I did was I put it down.
Oh.
Because I didn't know what to do with it. So I talked. I stood up and I talked in the middle of the circle. And I said, this is what my thoughts are.
Wow, you stood up and you talked?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
I don't remember what I said.
Right, but of course.
All I remember is the mistake I did, which was to put down the eagle feather. But no one chastised me. When I coming back, Ida put me more to work, and she said, well, would you be on the board of directors as youth rep? And I was like, youth rep? I don't even know who I am. How am I supposed to represent any of these youth who are, like, far more knowing? She's like, no, you can do it.
Sometimes that's exactly what we need, just to be working and immersed in what it is that we're looking for so that we can find ourselves in it.
She knew that. So I was on the board of directors in the Native Friendship Center, and every year they have this annual general meeting. And I knew, I had researched, I saw on this big map of Native Friendship Centers, there was a Friendship Center in Fort Smith, which is where I was born.
Oh.
I was like, oh my God.
Oh my God.
There's going to be people from where I was born at this meeting from across Canada. I had a list of everybody coming to the meeting, and I went to go look for this woman. Her name is Rita McNeil. I had all these questions. So I went up to her, and I was so nervous. I remember being just rambling. And I started off, I'm like, okay, hi, my name is Nina Sigalis. I'm from Fort Smith, and I don't know, like, I'm looking for my family, and I'm actually grew up in Munch anyways. Like, I was overwhelming her with all these things. And all she did was smile at me. And I was like, she must think I'm nuts. So I finished my story, and she just smiles, and she's like, I know who you are.
Oh, my God.
I was like, you know who I am? She's like, yeah, I held you as a baby.
No.
Like, I'm thinking she must mistake me for somebody else. Like, it all ran through my, all these doubts ran through my head. And she's like, I know who your mother is. And I know who your father is.
Oh my God.
I was like, how do you know who I am? And she said, because you're a dead ringer for your mother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Later on, I would see pictures of her, and I really am. She said, yeah. She said, I know who you are, and would you like to speak to your father? And back then, we didn't have cell phones, right? So she's like, well, why don't we go upstairs to my room, and we'll call your father. I'm like, I started crying. Mm. I was not crying. I was, like, ugly crying. And I was on the floor, and I think I fainted. I was sitting on the floor, and in the middle of the hall of this hotel with this woman who knew who I was. So I went up to her hotel room, and she's calling. She was George. She said, I have someone with me who wants to talk to you, and it's your daughter. And I was like, she had me to phone. It goes, hi, my girl. And it's really deep. He goes, hi, my girl. He had a deep voice. And I said, hi, Dad. He goes, I'm so glad I found you, or you found me, or something. And so we decided right away. He goes, do you want to come and see me? I said, yeah. If I didn't have money, I would have walked there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Like, that was, you know. So after that day, I remember calling my mom and dad who raised me. And I said, Dad, I said, you won't believe who I just talked to. And they said, who? I said, my birth father. And he couldn't believe it. And they couldn't believe it. But both my birth father and my dad both paid for my plane ticket. I have all that on video, too, when I met him for the first time. It's one of those moments where you think, I can't believe this is happening to me. And I started finding out my brothers and sisters. So in 97, I talked to my sister for the first time. And my biological older sister and my father, my biological father, they took a bus together to Montreal. So I met them. They stayed at my house, obviously. And they met my adoptive family. That was ridiculous. My parents were freaked out because obviously I had gotten used to them because me and my older sister Diane sound exactly alike. But my mother, my mom, and my dad, they just kept looking back and forth. Both of us went to their living room because we went to their house and we were laughing the same and they were just like, oh my God, another Nina. It was so crazy. And then my father, it was so emotional. My father spoke with my parents. My mom showed my father pictures of me growing up. He got very emotional and he said to me, and me and my sister stepped out, I remember, of the living room. And I remember hearing my father say to my parents, he said, thank you. He said, thank you for raising my daughter. And so, I'm really glad that they got to meet.
So was there a moment when you met, like, how many siblings did you find out you had? And did you meet them all?
I found out I have 6 siblings in all.
Wow.
I have 4 brothers and 2 sisters.
Okay. Have you ever all been together in the same place?
We were all separated. We were all adopted. We were all taken. My brother, Matthew, ended up in the Yukon. My other brother, John Paul, ended up in Fort Francis in Ontario. My other sister, Diane, grew up in Thunder Bay. My older brother, Eric, I think he was up in Inuvik. There was only one of us, Andy Ketuk, who was adopted into Senecaluwak. He was the only one adopted into an Inuit family. So he's the only one of us who speaks Inuktitut and has hunted traditional and who grew up like traditional. We met in Yellowknife. My sister was there. Monique was already there. And we had 2 of the 4 brothers that were going to be there. So there was 5 of us. There was Monique, Diane, me, John Paul, and Matthew. And it was amazing because there was a social worker who was there. She was retiring. And she gave me access, and all of us access to her file.
What were you able to find out through that? What did you discover?
A couple of things. It was interesting because my mother, my mom, and my dad who adopted me had to go to an evaluation. And it was a 4-page evaluation summary of their visit with them and who they were. And it was interesting to see someone else's point of view of who they were. Mm. But most importantly, I have a copy of the adoption papers. You know, and being adopted, you always think that they didn't want you. You just feel abandoned and not worthy and not good enough. But on this paper, my mother's name on the bottom, and there's a huge X through where she was supposed to sign, and she never gave her consent. And proof in front of me right there in September 99 was the fact that I was stolen. And over the years, my father has told me the story of how I was taken, which was my mother had brought me to the hospital because I had an ear infection. I got lots of those. And the nurse, both my parents actually went to residential school. They were violently abused and everything. But when they brought me to the hospital, the nurse had said, well, come get her tomorrow and we'll take care of her tonight. And when my mother came back the next day and my father, I was gone.
You were gone. Oh my gosh. I'm so sorry.
You're just a dirty Eskimo and nothing. There was just an assumption that I would be better off somewhere else. So But in that moment when I saw that adoption paper.
Yeah, what did that change for you?
It changed the fact that because my father told me that they tried looking for me, and like my mother didn't, she went to the hospital every day for days looking for me and yelling and screaming at the staff. But that paper showed to me was that what my father was saying was true, what my aunties had told me, which was true, which is my mother had never given me up.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. Mm-hmm. There was a piece of me that was healed because I thought it wasn't because I wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because she didn't want me. It's because they stole me.
What was your mother? What did she... So she was a leader in her community, or...?
She had always been a defender of people. She ended up living a very hard life after she got into alcohol because of the heartache that she had experienced and all the abuse. But She was an incredibly strong woman. Since I was 16, I knew I was going to be a social worker. Mm-hmm. And one of my first jobs that I took on was working at the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal. And I have that same instinct.
Do you feel like you're kind of continuing your mother's work here?
Yeah. Like, you know, even when I was younger, I would just go talk to people on the streets. And even as a teenager, I'd just be like, go sit on the street with them. I'd be like, hey, what's up? And do you want something to eat? And I'd go and share some food with them and just listen to them. And I was always the protector. Mm-hmm. I still am.
So tell me about your work now. Like, what do you do in community? And what does the community give back to you?
So for 25 years, I was a frontline worker. I worked at the Native Friendship Center, Chez Doris, Native Women's Shelter Montreal, the Women's Center of Montreal, but I did my DEC in social work. But my community, one of the things that happened when I first went to that Friendship Center when I was 18 was I was learning so many beautiful things from beautiful people during the daytime. But then on Friday nights, I would see the destruction. I didn't understand that historical scope for a while. I still had racist thoughts. Like, why can't they just stop?
Yeah.
Well, they opened my mind and my heart to what had happened in our community and that I was a part of that. I was a part of having been taken away, and they said, you were one of the stolen ones. And so that pain, they showed me, transmitted itself into trauma that was then expressed through addictions. So when I started looking at that, I realized that this is what I wanted to do. So at the Native Women's Shelter in Montreal, I was so adamant, and I was so passionate about keeping mothers and kids together. I would meet an Inuk woman who had lost her kids or who was at risk of losing her kids. And I did a lot of healing for myself. So even though as much as I was their advocate, as much as I wanted to fight with them, they healed a part of me because they made me understand what had happened to my mother without ever meeting her, through their journeys and through their struggles and their triumphs and their strength. I realized how strong my mother had to have been to go through what she went through, child after child after child after child, you know? And so I said, no wonder she ended up drinking. Like, no wonder.
Yeah.
The fact that she was so resilient and that she was still running for mayor up until a year before she passed. Having been a social worker for 25 years, I was fighting a lot against the systems, seeing lawyers dismissing mothers and judges dismissing mothers and fathers and policemen and doctors dismissing. And I also saw how our community would relate to non-Native workers. And as much as I could empower our community members to go, okay, well, these are your rights. This is what you got to do. This is the paperwork. This is what you need. I did it over and over and over and over, and no matter what we did, we still came up against this wall of racism and misunderstanding and judgment. And after 25 years, I thought someone else needs to take this.
And so you got this sort of Western education, and you're working through this Indigenous lens. Have you found any advantage to having that Western education? And then, you know,
tell me what those are. I'm laughing only because community members that I was walking beside to help them navigate all these services. They would, you know, upon meeting us, it was palpable feelings of being looked down upon.
And you're talking about when you're meeting with settler workers?
Yeah, settler workers who were part of the system that our community members had to work through to get their services, you know, and
yeah.
There was a lot of, like, looking down upon. But the minute I opened my mouth, and at first I would speak English, and I would say, well, I'm here with so-and-so, and she needs this service, and she's not comfortable because she doesn't speak French, or she doesn't, you know, I'm here just to make sure she understands what her rights are and everything, and then they would still be dismissive until I spoke English. And all of a sudden I would use 10 little words and talk about the systems and the rights, and I would be able to just quote things, and then I would speak French. And I have a French accent from France, because my husband was from France. Alors, quand je parle français, c'est vraiment comme ça, qui tout d'un coup, oh là là,
Oh damn.
Who knows what she's doing, and we can't trick this one.
Right.
For me, after 25 years of trying to help our community members go through yeah. these numbers of things, I decided, no, I'm no longer useful.
But I think that's the thing with this kind of work or practice or love or community, is that you kind of come forward with your gifts and you give and give, and then you have to kind of pull back. I mean, it's, yeah. You worked for 25 years, which is like a long fucking time before you actually pull back. But you pull back and you say, okay, now I need to change or take care of myself or something, because I'm not exactly what you said. I'm not useful at this point, in this time, in this context. I have to work at it from another angle. So what's your new angle now, or what have you been up to?
So I switched from working with the community members to working with the systems that our community members work in. I thought, you know what? Our community members can have all of the tools up to wazoo. If they don't understand, they, me being the non-native service providers, if they don't understand who we are, it doesn't matter. It will never matter.
Because they're working from this racist lens, and it doesn't matter what you do, they're still coming at it from the same perspective.
Yeah, and it's like the community members will always be dismissed. They will always have their rights trampled on, will always be profiled. So what I've started doing over the past maybe 5-10 years, more intensely over the past 5 years, is using my story and my family story, my birth mother's story, my father's story through a residential school, my story through 60s, who've been sharing that journey. And who I've been sharing it with are elementary school kids, elementary school teachers, high school students, high school teachers, university college students, university college professors, policemen. I work closely with the Canadian Army. What I also had to realize is that I had to put my anger down. I couldn't work from anger. You know, one of the things that my dad always told me was that peaceful resistance is the best resistance. So the anger that I had felt over 25 years, I had to deal with and put down. I couldn't carry that with me at the same time as doing this work of trying to help people understand who we were. Otherwise, they would be just learning from an angry person. And I realized that that would not serve us any purpose.
Right.
Because people are just going to, their defenses are going to go up. So what I've done is I opened my heart.
How do you do that with cops?
Cops is a whole, I still haven't cracked that one yet.
Tell me about those responses.
You know, what I've also come to understand is that the service providers are also struggling within a system that is also frustrating for them, because as much as they want to be compassionate and understanding, the laws that they have to follow are still given by Ottawa. So they're working within also a machine that is frustrating for them. But the reactions that I've had is that one-on-one, when I have repeated interventions or interactions with specific police officers and they get to know who I am, you can tell that their walls go from way high to, oh, I'm going to get shit on by this Native person, to going, okay, she's also a mother. She's also a community member. She understands. What I try to do is I try to start from the common, whether it's with the Army, and I go into the Canadian Army and I do three-day workshops, intense workshops with them. When you get grown as Army men crying because you've touched them with your
You know you've done your job.
I'm like, drop the mic, and I'm proud of myself. And it's not because I made them cry, but it's because...
It's a little bit that you made them cry. A little bit.
But it's, for me, it's the fact that they see me, and they now carry my parents' story. And that the next person, the next time that they see somebody, or they meet one of our community members, they will remember.
You're doing all this work with all these different communities, so... After trying to educate these military dudes, you come out. I would just assume that you're spent. Like, what are you doing now to fill yourself back up so you can continue?
I go home to my kids.
Oh my God, yeah.
What fills me up is the response after the first day, after the second day, and they are blown away. You're like, we had no idea. Thank you so much.
Can you tell me a bit about your work in the prison?
I've been part of this project through Concordia University to go in and do medicine bag workshop with Indigenous women who are in La Clare prison.
Just for context, that's the provincial prison.
I've had the great opportunity of working with Vicky Baldo, with Brittany, with Alex. There's a team of us, Wanda Gabriel. There's been a group of us that have gone in to offer cultural activities, workshops with Indigenous women, and the majority of them are Inuit. And so for the 3 days, we offer them cultural activities. We do smudging every morning. We do hand drum every day. We talk to them about trauma, anger, intergenerational trauma, and through medicine bags, which is they make their own medicine bag. We talk to them about the medicines and their journey, and it's for 3 days. They get to, first of all, see each other. We also bring in traditional food.
Oh, wow.
So let me ban it for 3 days, and it was great. They get to be around each other because they're isolated, right? So for 3 days, they get to be around each other. They get to speak their language. We also were researching their needs. So what happens in the prisons? What are some of the things that you've experienced, whether it's racism or, you know, all these things that are, they don't get heard? And so it was really difficult to go and leave, to be honest. But it was so, they gave us so much. And again, like, my biological mother had gone to prison, but I understood where our women are coming from, and where some of them end up in jail because of domestic violence, where they're defending themselves.
Then you said you go home and you see your kids, and they kind of fill you back up again.
I have my daughter, Nevaeh, who's 9. I have 19-year-old. I have my son, who's 28. I have my partner, who also is an incredible support and strength, because he is also a frontline worker. So he understands my like, I can't deal.
Yeah.
Both take turns of going, oh my God, I can't. My two girls really keep me going, because the work that I'm doing, and I tell that, I would say 90% of the time I end with the fact that, you know, being a mother, what heals me, how I heal myself, is doing this work. And I know it's not going to be immediate, but I'm hoping that this generation coming up, having heard what I've shared and what others have shared, that the future of my kids is a lot better.
Do you teach them about your culture? How were you able to do that?
Through music.
Yeah, tell me about your music.
You know, when I was 18, when I first met my first Native woman and first, you know, and I started learning that drumming was a big thing. And I went to my first powwow, and I did my first sweat, and I heard throat singing for the first time. And it was throat singing, and it blew me away.
Yeah.
Blew me away. Like, I just couldn't believe that we did that. So I met my friend Kakwalik Partridge in university, and she didn't know how to do throat singing either. So we went on a mission.
Amazing.
And we went through Evie Mark, who's an incredible throat singer, and we have been throat singing partners for 25 years. Okay. And so we're now best friends, and we've been through each other's marriages and weddings and children and births and pregnancies, but through throat singing, I've managed to show my girls who they are. And this is something that I never listened to when I was growing up, but they've heard it since they were in my belly, because I would throat sing while I was pregnant with them, and they know how. And I perform now with my oldest daughter, and we travel together to share throat singing and our history and the fact that it was almost wiped out. And, you know, that's part of my healing. And hand drumming for me, for a long time, I didn't feel like I was allowed to.
Mm. Imposter syndrome.
That's totally it. I'm like, they're going to know. Why don't I know this? I should know. But I have this beautiful woman in my life. Her name is Sedalia.
I was going to ask you about Sedalia. You got to talk about Sedalia.
Sedalia Fazio. So when I was in my late teens, I met her and her daughter. Her and her daughter and I went to school together. We went to Concordia. And her mom right away adopted me. She just adopted me. She's like, that's it. You're one of my... So I grew up also with a Mohawk mother who, through thick and thin, has put up with my shenanigans.
Right.
Let's just say that. She's guided me through ceremony. She's guided me through singing. And she's been, she is one of the greatest strengths in my life.
I feel like Sedalia is kind of a mom to a lot of people who don't otherwise have one or not close to theirs, or even for, you know, the Two-Spirit queer community. I find that she's really showing up for us, and kind of she's there to support. And
the Mohawk mom.
Mm.
I, you know, that I never knew I really needed. If I want truth from her, if I really want the honest truth about something, I will go in from her.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't hold anything back, and she tells me like it is. She was there when my husband died from cancer. She was there when my girls were born, and she loves my kids like they were her own. And
have you gotten to sing with her?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yes. Music for me has been a way to give myself permission and to come into myself, to be really, say, you know what? I can sing. I can sing. I'm allowed to sing. It's okay for me to sing. And Sedalia says I can't. So that's just.
That's all you need to know. If she says it's a go, it's a go. That's it.
It's healed a part of me. It's almost like my identity is catching up with my face. It's weird. My sense of self is catching up to my face, is what I feel like. And more getting older, too, and being a mother.
Yeah.
I'm like, I stand a lot stronger than I did 25 years ago when I was like, who the heck am I?
Yeah.
For me, throat singing has been a way to heal relationships, too. When I do my presentations, you know, people ask me to do throat singing. I try to leave people with an understanding of who we are. Yes, it's in the ancient, it's old, it's thousands of years old, but you also have to give us space to be content with them.
Have you gone back to your mom's community in the north? Yes. And learned songs that you'd never heard before? And were your siblings there?
Like, there's we have our own drum songs. Like, it's more tap, 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 tap. And it's like a lot of hand motions, and it's so gorgeous. It's so wonderful. I haven't had the opportunity to learn it. I try to watch it on YouTube, and I try to connect on for my community, but it's so far. Inupiaq is a long way to go. But that's one of the things, you know. Through the 60s Scoop settlement, you know, people are like, oh, you're getting all this money. Like, aren't you excited? And I'm like, no, I'm not. Because that money is not going to bring back my mother. That is not going to bring back my brothers and sisters or my aunties. Yeah. Or my language, or my ceremony, I have to do that, which is fine. But that money is not going to fix everything. What it can do is I will be able to bring both my girls up to do exactly what you asked.
Oh, yeah.
When the money gets released and we are allowed to travel.
Oh, yeah. Gee. Okay, we'll come to that.
I will take them up north to see where their grandmother is buried, and to meet my father's family. My father passed away a couple years ago from cancer. And I'm going to travel with them. And I hope to bring them up to Inupiaq, too. And I want them to see where they would have been raised. I want them to know Fort Smith. I want them to hear the language. I want them to eat the food. I want them to see the forest, because in Fort Smith, they would have grown up around the forest. I want them to meet their elders, their aunties, the ones who would have cared for them.
So speaking of the travel restrictions, it's March 23rd, 2020. We're in the middle of the COVID fiasco pandemic. And how are you coping?
I've really enjoyed our conversation today.
Right?
This has been so healing for me. Well, it's interesting because I'm such a social person and I'm a hugger. I care a lot for my community and my friends. And every time I see one of my frontline worker friends, I always hug them and I just hold them and I encourage them because I know what it was like to be in their front line. And so it's been very hard for me to not do that for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real struggle because I also suffer from anxiety and depression, which is something that I don't normally talk about. But I need to also share with people that that's what I suffer from because, mm-hmm. but I also managed to go through it. So the depression and anxiety has been overwhelming sometimes, but I'm very grateful and thankful that I have a home. You know, I have a big enough home that we're not all cramped together. We have a beautiful backyard. So that's what some of the ways, and my little one here, you know, we've been TikToking. I don't know. I don't really, not really good at it.
But yeah.
The older one is cooking up a storm with what I get from the store. My partner is holding down the fort with us, and my niece who lives with us is also, she has a very gentle energy. So I've been singing. I did tantrum outside with my daughter. She brought her drum. And that's one of the things, too, is, like, I didn't even ask her to come out with me. But I went outside with my drum, and she came outside, and she whispered to me. She's like, that song.
It's the strong woman song. I hear Vicky sing that a lot.
Yeah. And I said, you want to sing that? She's like, yeah. She led it. My 9-year-old. She came out. She was like, that's the song we have to sing. I said, okay. So we sang it. For them to feel that they have the right to do that, to not even question, I've done it.
You've done your job.
For them to do that, and for my older one to know how to throat sing, and it just is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's how I healed, and they healed me.
Do you have anything else that you want to add right now?
You know, one of the things that when I just talking with you and going through this transition of, you know, being isolated and it's the springtime and it's the spring solstice and it's very stressful, but it's also the fact that my parents have gone through what they went through, with the fact that my mother went through residential school for 9 years. She was isolated for 9 years.
My God.
9 years. And my biological father was also isolated from his family for 10 years. And they went through what they went through. And there's a whole generation of parents who went through that. This is all right.
Yeah.
I just need to think of what my mother was thinking in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And what it took for her to keep going.
Yeah.
And to believe and have kids. And to keep moving forward. I try to keep her in mind. Mm. And I try to keep my father in mind. And my grandparents who lost their kids. And it's like, this is not the first hard times we fall upon as a people. Yeah. You know? And now other people understand what we've been through. Of not having anything to do. And not having enough toilet paper. But that's what I've been thinking about. I'm just wishing everyone health and balance and mindfulness and peaceful, inner peace. And it's okay not to be okay. I want to tell people it's really okay not to be okay. Take the strength from our ancestors.
Hi. This is so healing for me too. And just like getting all these medicines together for all of us to share. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
In a heartbeat. In a heartbeat. Yeah. Anytime.